The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Commander Mark Devine here, coming at you from SEAL Fit headquarters in sunny Encinitas, California. Welcome to this week's podcast. And I am stoked to share a conversation I had with Captain Bob Schultz, former Navy SEAL, retired Navy SEAL, I should say, former commander of Naval Special Warfare Group 2 and SEAL Team 2 and a host of other places. Bob is a terrific guy. I first met him at University of San Diego, where he was running a master's program. And man, I wish I had known him my full SEAL career. What a great guy. We're going to have a lively conversation about ethos, and what the SEAL ethos means, and its shortcomings, and it's good stuff. So I hope you enjoy it. And before we get started, let me remind you that if you'd like to stay up to date on any special offers only available to the SEAL Fit tribe, as well as get the latest weekly podcast and SEAL Fit TV episodes and my weekly workout challenge, as well as a mental wad all emailed to you, then drop your email into our opt-in list at sealfit.com on the homepage of sealfit.com. All right, here we go. Conversation with Captain Bob Schultz. Hoo-yah.
Hey, folks. This is Commander Mark Devine coming to you from Unbeatable Mind. Welcome to this month's subject matter expert call. I'm really stoked to have Captain Bob Schultz with us this month. Bob is, and I have known each other for several years, since my days at University of San Diego. Bob is a retired Navy SEAL, spent several years longer than I did in the community, the bulk of his first career, I should say. And anyways, Bob has done did an amazing job at our Unbeatable Mind retreat, and so I wanted to invite him back on here. But before I get into the content, let me give you a little bit of his bio, so you understand just who we're dealing with here. And I'll probably end up reading what I have here because he's done some pretty interesting things and it'd be worth reading. So Bob graduated from Stanford University back in 74. He studied philosophy there, which is relevant to, what came later in his career and what he's doing now. He started, he's an officer, he's commissioned in the Navy as an ensign, went through BUDS in Coronado, and then in the summer of 75, then he went to, had various tours all over the place, just like, all officers do. He was commander of a SEAL team, and I'll ask Bob to tell us which one, because I don't have that in my bio here. Special Boat Squadron, all the way up to Commodore of NAVSEC War Group 2 back in Little Creek as an 06. He was also, in his last tour, Director of Leader and Character Development at the Naval Academy, retired in 2005. Since then, and this is where I met him, I actually didn't meet Bob on active duty, but I met him when he retired at the University of San Diego, where he took over from my friend Jerry Singleton to head up the Masters of Science in Global Leadership at the School of Business Administration at the University of San Diego. And he was there until November of 2011. And now Bob is kind of launching into his third career as a speaker on leadership primarily and character development and those types of things. He's a consultant, and his company is called Fifth Factor Leadership. Bob's married, been married for 34 years. He's got three kids, one of whom was a Zen monk and the other who is a Navy SEAL. So we have a lot to talk about with Bob. He's, he is definitely has an unbeatable mind and is, near and dear to my heart. I love this guy. So, Bob, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today. Really an honor to have you here.
Well, thank you, Mark. A quick amendment to your bio. I never commanded a SEAL team. I commanded an overseas unit. And
okay.
For those people who haven't been in the SEALs, one might not understand. I tell people it was a SEAL team, but actually I commanded the unit in Panama where the SEAL teams sent us people, and we deployed them and managed them all over Latin America, managing all the SEAL stuff in Latin America at the time. And I did not command a special boat squadron, though underneath the Spec War Unit 8 in Panama, we had SBU 26. And so I'm kind of an honorary member of the special boat community, which I'm proud of.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, well, thanks for that clarification. I wasn't sure about that. So, you know, Bob, you kind of had a pretty rich career in Spec War. And you went into it with a background in philosophy. Tell me again, you know, one of the things that really impressed me about, you know, when we first met was how you really had a strong philosophical orientation to warriorship and warrior development. And obviously that must have been influenced by your undergrad degree in philosophy at Stanford, and then, of course, your work at the Naval Academy. But, you know, not all SEALs and military people share that. You know, I've always long said that you have the guys who just like to play whack-a-mole, and then you have the guys who really are there to be warriors. You know, how did you really develop your interest in character development and, you know, some of the finer aspects of leadership?
Well, I think the thing that drew me to philosophy was my interest in trying to understand what was important and trying to understand myself and the context that I lived in. And I went into the SEALs because I had to pay back my ROTC scholarship. And
right.
And this looked like a fun way to do it. And I'd been an athlete in high school and in college, and I'd wrestled at Stanford and in high school. And this looked like a way to be athletic, have a good time, and pay back my 4-year commitment. And of course, it turned into 30 years. I found a home. I enjoyed it. I did not find a lot of my SEAL buddies were particularly interested in philosophy, but there are people in the community who are. They just don't share it openly because it's not a part of sort of the culture that we have. But I think that while I was in the 30 years I was in, I continue to pursue this. Why are we doing this? Why am I here?
Right.
Where does what I do fit into the larger context of how to live well? And am I doing it here now? And I found that I was able to live well in from a larger sense, not just financially, but I had a good life in my 30 years. I enjoyed it a lot. And I found myself at this character leader development position at the end of my career. And that really, really resonated with me. And I found that what I liked about it was what I really liked about being a leader in the Navy, and that was developing people, helping them to find their path, helping them to understand where they fit in and understand their own values. And that's what I got into at the Naval Academy in a big way, kind of going full circle from where I started at Stanford, and then pursued that for the next 6 years at the University of San Diego, running that master's program that you were associated with. And
right.
I'm still doing that now in my business speaking, teaching, consulting. So
right.
It all kind of ties together in a strange sort of way.
No, it definitely does. I get it. You know, let's go back to the beginning. You know, philosophy, you know, education is different than the experience of, you know, learning how to live well. What were some of the things that, I mean, it's nice to go into the SEALs with that backdrop, you know, to read Aristotle and to really think, you know, and ponder those great thoughts. But again, that doesn't make you a man. That just gives you some content. So what were some of the experiences in maybe your early days that helped you kind of really forge your own character and help you develop the words around your, you know, what you would call or I would call your personal ethos, you know, that guiding, you know, kind of statement or concepts around how to live well, as you understood it?
Well, to begin with, when I first came into the SEAL program, I still was struggling with the culture of change from being a footloose, fancy-free, thinking college student to being a SEAL or a UDT SEAL warrior, and I didn't do well with that cultural adjustment at first. And frankly, during my first my first tour, I was put on probation, and my platoon commander recommended that I be thrown out of the SEAL teams, not for any particular action. Yeah, because I didn't fit, and I was being told I didn't fit, and I knew I fit. I just hadn't learned to adjust my style to the culture of the SEAL community. And
right.
Once I learned to do that, I fit in a lot better. And interestingly enough, I was called to testify at the board that ended up throwing out the officer that recommended that I be thrown out. There was a little bit of sweet revenge in that, but
right.
he didn't fit in either. He did not fit. I fit better than he did. He just didn't know it. but I think that one of the things that came out of that was this resilience, the idea that frequently we have to be patient and things don't work right away. And
right.
It actually took me about 6 or 7 years to find my footing in the community, and when I found it, I found it pretty well, and since I felt been able to offer something that was unique to me to the community. So back to your first question, what were some of the key experiences? One, that not succeeding right off the bat
right.
Forced me to really think about who I was and whether I wanted to, and dig down deep and find the resilience to adapt and adjust and still hold on to my own personal identity.
Right. Yeah, that's a valuable one. Kind of shared some of that myself. And, you know, found that some of the most valuable learning experiences, of course, were ridiculously painful. And when did
also, I think that some of the people who hit the ground running right away and that looked like it was a great fit for them, particularly in the officer world, after by the time they got to be senior lieutenants, they weren't cutting it.
Right.
And there are different skill sets required at different levels of leadership.
Right.
And this is one of the challenges. I talked to the commander of basic training command. Now, how do you not filter out the guys early who may not be great at the right out of the blocks, but who have a lot of the skill sets and the personality and the character and the ethos to succeed well at the 04 and above level.
Right. And that's very true.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, so here's the question. You know, when did you first literally pen a ethos statement? You know, a personal guiding statement.
Well, when I was preparing my remarks for the Unbeatable Mind Academy conference, I realized that I've never actually sat down and penned a single statement, which was, this is my personal ethos. I was doing it as I was thinking. I had enjoyed those remarks so much because it forced me to stop and think about the
right.
issues a lot. But in a related way, when I had my letter in to get out of the SEALs after 4.5 years, and I'm writing, and I remember being with my platoon in Belgium, and
right.
staying up one night, writing down for myself, and I was 26, 27, I was 27 years old at the time, and I was writing down for myself, what do I want to be able to say about myself when I'm 40?
Right.
And I made a list of things that I wanted to say. These are the things that I can say I have done. These are the things I can say about myself. And I wrote that down because I knew I was going to come back from that deployment and get out of the Navy.
Right.
And I needed some to help myself get through that transition period. And that statement, and I've looked around for the piece of paper, but I've lost it. But there were several things on there that I do remember, and they helped me make a couple of fundamental key decisions that have led to my happiness and whatever success I've achieved after that by thinking through that. And so I think it's an important process. And when I posted my blog on personal ethos, I got one of the responses I got was from a friend of mine who was 74, 75 years old.
Right.
And he came back and said, you know, my ethos today at age 74 is different from what it was when I was 60, which is different from what it was when I was 50, which is different from what it was when I was 40.
Absolutely.
And as he says, as I've grown and had experience and matured and broadened my own perspective, my values have adjusted, shifted, and who I want to be also adjusts and shifts with that.
Right.
I thought that was pretty profound.
Yeah, I do. I do too. That's really neat. The you know, you said something really critical, and you know, that all came about because you asked yourself a question. The question is, what do I want to, you know, say about myself at 40? You know, what kind of person do I want to be, or what, you know, how do I want to be perceived by others? And so I've often said in Unveiled Mind that the quality of our life really is dictated by the quality of the questions we ask. That then will provide, you know, guiding instructions, right, for our brain, which then, you know, triggers the thought patterns and the imagery, and everything else kind of flows from there. And you shared at the Unveiled Mind retreat, I think 10 or 11 kind of questions, which can be used to help, you know, guide your development of what eventually is a personal ethos, which is just basically a set of criterion for living a good life, you know, as you defined it, which I think is right on. And then I think that's what you summarized in your blog post. But can you share, you know, a few of those with us now, and just, you know, help the Unveiled Mind community with some really good questions that they can ask themselves?
Yeah, without going through all of them and
right.
The whole thing, I started off with, am I ready to deal with failure?
Right.
And how do I deal with not getting what I want? And that's something that is important to figure out. And also, it's important to figure out what do I want that's really important. And do I want the right things? And that was inspired by a friend of mine, a young man who did not make it through SEAL training, and this was what he had wanted for almost his whole life, and he feels like his life is over. And
right.
I'm telling him, you know, I told the story at the conference. Becoming a SEAL or getting into a certain college or getting the right girl to fall in love with you or whatever, those are means to an end. And what is the end? And the end is to be a person of character and to live well.
Right.
And if you don't get something you want, then you can either keep trying and find another way, or you find another path to get around that one means, which may be a door that's closed to you, which opens up another door. And
right.
In my life, and I think I know that in your life, because I know some of your life story, there are things that you did not get what you wanted, and what that did is it turned you in a direction which opened up a door which was actually way better than the first one to begin with.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
So,
you know, I think that those two questions are fantastic, and you could, you know, literally just, you know, linger on those for days and weeks. But you're spot on, you know, that whole idea of, you know, what do I want and how you define that is really important. You know, had I personally set my sights on wanting to be a SEAL 06 or a SEAL Admiral, you know, or even a SEAL for 30 years. And when I reached that inflection point, you know, with my wife and those conversations about, you know, staying and going, it would have been a much different decision than had I defined what I want as to be a good person, to be a warrior, and to make a contribution. And so, you know, with that different definition, which fit within the context of being a SEAL, or vice versa, it gave me a lot of latitude to make a better decision, right? That, like you said, opened up the world to me.
And ultimately, becoming a SEAL really is, for everybody, a means to an end. And
right.
The end is we want to be respected. We want to live a life well lived. And
right.
there are SEALs that are not respected, are not living good lives.
Right.
And the farther you move on past that, you realize that that was just a step on the path towards living the life you want. But it's not the only step. It's not necessarily the best step. It's the step I took. It's the step you took. But again, keeping your front sight focused on the big issue, which is living well, living a good quality life, is hard sometimes.
Yes, indeed. And that second question, how do you deal with failure? I mean, I think that's so important for developing resiliency and just developing or understanding, you know, creating a relationship with failure where it's not personal and it's not perceived as a stop point or, you know, where you have to like pack your bags and go home, you know, and you know better than I do that SEALs learn to embrace that failure and they move toward it. so that they can learn a better way to do things. And so that I've always loved that term, failure is not an option, not because of the simple definition or the simple way to look at it, but more that failure is not an option because failure doesn't exist. It's a mental construct.
Yeah, interesting. You remember I used the famous Michael Jordan quote about all the shots he's missed and all the games he's lost and how many times he was given the last chance for the game-winning shot in the last seconds, how many times he missed. And he says the reason why he's had such a successful career is because he failed so many times.
Right. That's awesome. So what else? Those are two really good questions to help kind of set the foundation for the ethos. What were some of the other really good ones?
The next point I made in my remarks was about, am I ready to deal with hardship and tragedy, which is different from failure, not getting what I want. I mean, they're related, but how we all lose people, or something bad happens, we lose our home, or maybe we have an accident, we're not going to be able to do something, one of our hobbies or sports that has been so important to us, and this is almost a thing that comes to a point of faith, comes to the stoic acceptance of things you can't control.
Right.
And so I think about, and at the end, I think the last one I brought up in the remarks was embracing death.
Right.
And once you embrace death, then these other things become less important. I picked up a book that was recommended to me at one of the seminars I taught, and it is fabulous. Have you heard of the book High Altitude Leadership?
No, I don't think I have.
Wow, when you pick that up and start reading it, Mark, it'll blow your mind.
Great.
And I mean the first chapter itself is Fear of Death, and this is a business leadership book. Get that.
Is the guy a Buddhist?
It's actually written by a leadership consultant named Don Schminke, who has another book out, which is the Code of the Samurai applied to business, and a world-renowned mountain climber like Mount Everest, K2, that kind of guy, who has been up in the most austere environments, watched some of his partners fall and die on the mountains he's been climbing, and what are the lessons learned from that in the world of business. But this idea of embracing one's death in figurative or literal terms allows one to bring into perspective the inevitable loss of people or things that are important to us in our life.
Right. No, I love that. I think that's super powerful. One of the drills that I have the Unbeatable Mind trainees do in the seminars is, and I don't know, I can't remember if we addressed it at the retreat, but is to write their epitaph.
Yeah, that's a great exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Just to contemplate that moment, right? And it's not the same as, you know, what Don is talking about in his book, I don't think. You know, just you know, doing a fantasy trip into the future and thinking about what, you know, how you want to be remembered is one thing. But, you know, kind of from the Eastern perspective or the samurai perspective, to truly be at peace with this idea of your mortality, so much so that you have non-attachment to your body, even. I mean, that's advanced, right? That takes a lot of courage. And I think that's probably, you know, his point, is that leadership takes courage. And so why don't we start there, right, by embracing your mortality and living, and that you know, causes you to live every day with your hair on fire.
Yeah. It's certainly easier when you've done that to go ahead and step forward and do the right thing, the thing that you really believe in, and without too great a concern for what people are going to think or what's going to happen or trying to, you know, game the system, which, yeah, we all have to play the game of life. But if that becomes your whole life is playing the game of life, then you miss what's really important.
Well said. I agree. You're very influenced by the, you know, Greek philosophy and Stoicism, aren't you?
I find a lot of in Stoicism that resonates with me. I can't use all of it. I once wrote one of my blog posts was on Stoicism: the good, the bad, the ugly.
Right.
But I really find over and over again, I default to that as a good going in position. And there are some aspects of if you get into the philosophy itself that in a deep way that I don't completely abide with or completely on board with, but by and large, the maintaining the value on one's honor and to concern oneself with what you can control and right. to let the things you can't control go. Reinhold Niebuhr's Serenity poem, the serenity to change the things I can to, how does it go? Accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Wisdom to know the difference, right, exactly. So what did you find lacking in Stoicism, the bad and the ugly?
The bad is it depending on how you interpret it, there can be a certain fatalism, you know,
right.
to it, and I continue to believe that you can make a difference. Just find a way to make a difference.
Right.
That also that there can be a concern about not there not being enough room for joy and fun.
Yeah.
Fun in it. It's a fairly austere philosophy, but
right.
then again, if Admiral Stockdale was the Stoic that I'm most familiar with in Epictetus, he was a fun-loving guy too, and he had fun. So you know, I think that if you take the essence of it, which is live honorably, don't concern yourself with things that you can't control, and concern yourself with the things you can control, and which includes your attitude, your actions, and your decisions, and the rest, let the rest fall in place. In most cases, that's pretty damn good advice.
For sure. Have you ever compared Stoicism to Eastern philosophy, such as Buddhism, and seen whether there's a universal thread that runs through the two?
I tried to with the Code of Bushido a number of years ago, and I frequently say that Bushido is Stoicism on steroids. And Bushido, as a Westerner, is kind of over the top extreme in its warrior approach
right.
to being a warrior.
Right.
Yet I think there's still a lot we can learn from it. I actually did do a study between existentialism, which is and Stoicism, and found some interesting overlap because both of them have used the saying that it's not what matters is not what happens to you. What matters is how you deal with what happens to you.
Right.
And yet they both have a very different approach. Stoicism is very reason focused and reason based, and existentialism is very passion based. And,
right.
And the existentialist will argue that you should be, you know, fighting your destiny and defining yourself as an individual, fighting the crowd, fighting your destiny, define yourself as a creative individual in the universe. And the Stoic will say, nah, you know, if your fate is to go along, you're a dog on the leash being pulled along by the car, and you're killing yourself.
Right.
So,
do you have a copy of that that comparison study? I'd love to read it myself and share it with our folks.
Yeah, I can find it. I did it about. It was actually in PowerPoint slides. I put it together as a presentation, which I gave to at the Naval Academy, and I can still find it. And I found that some of the people who were, I was trying to identify Stoic heroes and existential sages, and a number of them were the same. I saw Admiral Jim Stockdale as a Stoic sage and an existential hero. He swam
right.
against the current. He stood up against the current in the Navy when he came back from Vietnam. He didn't give
right,
a shit what the culture of the Navy said. This is what I'm going to do, and screw you guys. This is the right thing to do. And he did that for his whole life, particularly after he came back from Vietnam. A very
right.
Existential hero thing, as well as a Stoic sage thing.
That's fascinating. And so, you know, I'm kind of curious your thoughts about the future of education and teaching, you know, these, you know, powerful philosophies, and it's kind of sad that we don't really have a way to convey them in our, you know, general academic programs. You know, you have to kind of search for, you get it a little bit at military academies, and if you find the right teacher here and there, like yourself, but Do you see, you know, with your work and also the work that I'm doing here, more people, you know, kind of trying to learn some of these fundamental philosophies that form the basis of Western civilization rather than just the current pop culture that they're fed every day by media?
There are people who would really love this stuff and have never been exposed to it. And I still teach business ethics at University of San Diego. And right. Every one of my classes, we teach the fundamentals of Aristotelian virtue ethics. And I have them read Courage Under Fire by Admiral Stockdale. And right. so many of them, but not all of them. But I'd say 25 or 30% of my students go, wow, this is great stuff. I didn't know any of this.
Right.
How can I learn more? And then others aren't at all interested. Doesn't make them bad people. I've known some of the best people whose character and leadership I would hold up to anybody in the world could care less about this stuff.
Right.
And I also know some people who can argue and talk about Aristotle all day long, and I wouldn't trust them with $10. So my point is I don't want to overvalue. The interest in this. It's something that I'm interested in. And I told a story about an officer, and I'll name him because he's a really still a fine officer on the team. Name is Nick Pinkston. And he was in the Naval Academy, he was a midshipman, and he was a philosophy geek, and he was wanted to go to SEAL training. And so we kind of connected because I'm into that too. And when he's going through Bud's training, he sends me back an email and tells me, "Sir, the guys in Bud's are really into Aristotle. They just love the stuff on Aristotle that I share with them." And I typed back to him. I said, "Come on, Nick. You think I was born yesterday? I know the community. That's bullshit." And he comes back and says, no, it's really true. The only thing is I just have to present it the right way. I never used the word Aristotle, and I just dropped the F-bomb about every third word, and they really like the philosophy.
That's awesome.
So basically, he had the gift. Master Chief Will Guile is another guy who had the gift of taking these ideas and putting them into language that young warriors could appreciate and were able to relate to and develop that kind of interest. So the point of education, you know this old saying that when the student's ready, the teacher will appear.
Right. You know, when we do Kokoro Camp, we have the class memorize the short form of the SEAL ethos, you know, like lead with honor on and off the battlefield, right? Or serve with honor on and off the battlefield and earn your trident every day. And the six statements that define, you know, the short version of that. And it's a powerful motivator for the team. And but, you know, we had this discussion about how it doesn't necessarily make a great personal ethos. And in fact, you know, I agree with you largely because a personal ethos is personal. It's very personal. It's not the same as a team ethos. It's meant to drive an institution's values and norms and behavior. But, you know, how do we, you know, besides when once you, let's say you sit down with your journal and you start asking yourself these questions, you know, what does it mean to then kind of develop it into an ethos, right? I mean, first of all, you have just an understanding or awareness of who you are, kind of what drives you. But how do we then take the step of turning it into guidelines for behavior, right? I guess that's kind of an interesting thought point or question.
Well, I think your book, The Way of the SEAL, you talk about defining your values, and I think that's really important. But the reality is that you define your values every time you make a decision.
Right.
And I was talking to the business leaders today, and I was in my session that I was having, and I said, you know, you can say all you want about your organization and your values and the ethos for your organization, but people are watching what you actually do.
Right.
And the decisions you make. And you can distill out of the decisions you've made in your life what your real values are.
Right.
And if you do that and you sit down and think about the big and little decisions, you see what your values are. And if you don't like them, then you don't like the direction you're going, then then you've got to start changing your decisions. And if you create an ethos with a different value, you're going to come up on a crossroads, and you're going to have to make a decision: do I turn left or do I turn right? And that's going to define who you are. One of the books that we use in the course that I teach is called Defining Moments. And this guy who is the ethics chair at the Harvard Business School basically says you define yourself with your decisions.
Right.
So, back to your question, as a guide to life, I think one of the first questions is, okay, what implicit guide to life are you already operating on?
Right.
And understanding that is the first step, because if you come up with something that's really radically different from that, you're probably not going to follow it, because you've got a momentum going in a certain direction.
Right. Well, it certainly would take a lot of work and a lot of awareness to break those habits of thought. So,
when you made your decision to get out of the Navy because of what your family values are, you made a statement to yourself and the world as to where your values were.
Right.
And that was a hard decision for you, and it was a key decision, but it was also clarified what was really important to you. And you and other people come up with on these sorts of, you know, when I decided to leave University of San Diego to go do what I'm doing now, that was not an easy decision. I was leaving a good job with a comfortable income and a comfortable lifestyle to go into a world of uncertainty. And kind of part of what I was doing was, hey, this is what I preach: get out of your comfort zone, and I can stay here and keep doing this, but even though I'm losing my passion for it, or I can go jump out into the void. And okay, it's really not the void because I have a pension, but
right.
There's some risk here, and I'm willing to do it. So I think that I'm not sure that it would be interesting, and I've never done it, to sit down and put together all those 10 points that I made and try put that into a concise statement that makes up that sums up my personal ethos.
Right.
I have not done that. It would be an interesting drill to do. Maybe I ought to come to one of your seminars.
Yeah, that would be interesting for sure. We'd have some lively discussions. Yeah, putting it down on paper is causes you to really take a stand, right? To draw a line, and you know, life isn't always that black and white. You know, the point is to put the thought in. And, you know, once you put it on paper, you might change it the next day because you have another deeper insight. And the other thing that I was thinking about when you're talking about my decision, you know, when you bring other people into your life, and such as a family or a wife, then a family, all of a sudden it's a sea change in the way you see yourself and your relationship to others. And, you know, it's kind of like joining the SEALs in the team. Now your personal values have to be inclusive of your teammates. Because, you know, they're, like you said, they're watching you, and it affects the trust bond and the accountability relationship. And it's not just you out there hanging out there alone. And, you know, it's that the integral nature of things. We live in the I, we, and the it. And so that's why, you know, I think this is an ever evolving, you know, concept, this idea of a personal ethos. And you may have a personal ethos and a team ethos, right, and an organizational ethos, but they sure better line up and support each other, right?
Yeah. And this idea, one of the values that I put into the 10 points I did is recognizing that we're part of a community. And
right.
My personal ethos can't be just about me fulfilling my personal goals. Anybody who's married in a committed relationship or has a family knows that that there are other people, include not only the family, but parents, siblings, the community.
Right.
They have a stake in what you do.
Right.
And finding the right balance between complying with what everybody else wants you to have, they want you to live your life, but at the same time living your own life, but then recognizing your responsibilities to your community. There's not a formula for that. It's a personal thing, and it's hard.
Right. Before I forget, I wanted to ask you, because I've got my Amazon app. I've already ordered the High Altitude Leadership. You know, that's kind of how nutty I am about books. They stream in here, and I try to read them as fast as I can. But so you mentioned defining moments. There's two of them listed. One's by a fellow named Badaracco.
That's the one.
Is that the one?
Joe Badaracco.
Joe Badaracco. Okay, so it's the first one listed. I just wanted to get that out there because a lot of times when we mention books on these calls, then our members will like to go pick up the book, and a lot of times we'll create a little chatter about it in our Facebook group and whatnot. So Joe Badaracco, Defining Moments When Managers Must Choose Between Right and Right. Okay.
And I love the book, and I loved it so much I went and read everything else I could find that he wrote, and everything he's written I love. And he talks about non-heroic leadership, and I love that too. That whole idea of picking your battles and not necessarily setting yourself on fire over little things when there are bigger things to pay attention to.
Right. That's cool. Well, we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to take a few moments to talk about your your work up there in Canada. And, you know, you mentioned earlier when we first started chatting about teaching commando leadership to these business leaders. Can you give us the 1,000-mile view of what that is, what your view of that is?
Basically, it goes on the assumption that all of us want to be part of an elite tribe. I found that in my experience with special operations, where I didn't call it SEAL leadership because I think it's true of the same basic leadership works in any elite military unit, SEALs, Special Forces, Marine Recon, the best fighter squadrons, and people want to work in an elite tribe organization. And my point to the business leaders is, you want to come to work every day, and you would like to have your business also replicate the idea of being an elite tribal organization where people feel that they're a part of something special. They feel good about being there. They want to give everything they have to be a part of that organization. And that's where people want to work. And that's why people stay in the SEAL teams and want to get in. And I think that's also possible in business. So I also retitled it Developing an Elite Corporate Culture, and that's what we talk about.
Okay. And it's interesting where a lot of fear in the business world about the pace of change and what we're, you know, where we're going with the world and how technology is disrupting everything. And what came to mind while we were talking is that, you know, a lot of these organizations, you know, I was at a seminar Thursday and Friday last week called Abundance, and we looked at all these technologies and kind of what's happening in the world and where we're going to be in 5 years. So we're trying to forward look. And I heard from the presenter that it's estimated that 40% of Fortune 500 companies are expected to be gone within the next 5 years. And these are, you know, organizations that employ thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And you know, a lot of these executives don't have time right now to think about how to create an elite culture. They're in survival mode. They're trying to figure out how the heck to like reinvent themselves. And I think, you know, that creates a real interesting challenge, you know, for these organizations. Like how do we both upgrade our culture and be more nimble and be an elite tribe while we're being leapfrogged because of technological innovations that make it easier to develop our products faster, you know, and cheaper. Do you ever get any questions like that, or, you know, leaders just saying, hey, how do we, you know, let's back up and just how do we freaking handle this change that's coming upon us?
And that's really a great question, because the whole idea of innovation and leadership and chaos is an area that I've actually done some work in, and I find that really it requires some imagination on the part of the leader's part.
Right.
And if the leader is wrapped around the axle in problem solving and putting out fires in his own company, a lot of businesses have conflated the leadership and the management roles into one person.
Right.
They're not going to see the sucker punch that's coming around the corner because they're going to be so down in the weeds.
Right. I agree with that.
Somebody has got to step back and be looking out into the future, thinking about what the competition is doing, reading Fast Company magazine and the Wall Street Journal, and going to these seminars And if the lead, but if the leader is down in the weeds, just problem solving and putting out fires, the organization is not going to be very agile and is going to be surprised and going to be way behind the power curve and is going to have to go into crisis mode and may or may not survive.
Right. Yeah,
that's my response. But a lot of times I've seen companies save money by combining the management and the leadership roles into one person. And the leader is working 20 hours a day or working 70 hours a week, just trying to keep things on track and make sure that they're growing and that the profits are coming in, and they're not paying attention to the really important, they're paying attention to the urgent issues, but the important issues are being left on the table. And the important issues over the long run are the culture of the organization and looking out beyond and seeing these issues that you're pointing at, the change, what's going on in the marketplace, what's happening with technology, what are my competitors doing, and thinking about what that means. Because if nobody's doing that, the rest of the organization is going to suffer when all of a sudden they get their butt handed to them and they start losing market share and percentage points every month.
Right. You know, we were looking at some of the companies that have gone from zero to, you know, over $1 billion in revenue in, you know, 2 to 3 short years, some of these new internet companies. And a lot of these, you know, are run by teams of between 5 and 10 people. And then they're leveraging the crap out of, you know, the crowd, right? Using crowdfunding, uh-huh. Crowdsourcing, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, Intel and all these other companies, these Fortune 500s I'm talking about, have to get on board with these new ways of doing business and figure out how to create an elite culture. And interestingly enough, Bob, we also talked about how your most important asset in the future, not today being the future, is your tribe. And defining that tribe both as your internal tribe and your external tribe, meaning, you know, employees, independent contractors, people creating things for you, creating productivity, and your external tribe being those who are enjoying the benefits of that productivity, and how those, you know, a lot of times the boundary line between those two is blurring, and we want to increase the size and the connection with the tribe. It's just really interesting terminology, and you know, it's very, you know, humanistic and biological, the way that business is evolving in the language that we're using. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, you're hearing the word tribe come up a lot. I mean, Seth Godin's got a book out called Tribes. You've got
right.
tribal leadership. And
right.
Pretty soon it's going to become a cliched word and it's going to lose its meaning. But I think that the idea of being part of a group that feels elite.
Right.
And it has what a really good Special Forces A team or a SEAL platoon or a company like Zappos or Google or some of the others that are breaking new ground and breaking and creating new paradigms for how people relate to their work and that's where people want to work. And they don't want
right.
to come in and just kind of be put into their cubicle, told to shut up and do their job, and they want to feel engaged and empowered and enfranchised in the total purpose. That's
right.
that's what a great tribe looks like to me.
No kidding, and they're going well beyond, you know, kind of how these special operations teams, you know, operate. Obviously, there's different environments and structures, but you know, like Zappos literally just gave up job descriptions and hierarchy. I mean, they're completely flat. And so you go in there to work and you got a specialty, but then, you know, you have little hives that pop up to go solve problems, you know, because you're all part of the same team. And you couldn't do that unless you had an elite orientation, meaning you did feel like you're part of something special.
Yeah, they've got these leaderless teams, concepts people are experimenting with. It's interesting,
right.
one of the Vistage groups I spoke to, the chair had taken his Vistage group to Zappos for a tour, and then he also took them over to Buds to compare
uh-huh.
two really different, but both of them are elite, consider themselves elite and are groundbreaking in the way they do business and have a very different ethos, but there's still something that ties them together and they're proud to be there. They support each other. They're excited about it. One's kind of geeky and and young people kind of geeky, and then there's the kind of warrior culture that they saw at SEALs. But both of them had some things in common, and he generated this discussion about what did they really have in common, as different as they looked.
Right. Well, I can tell one thing right off the top, just from listening to you, is that both organizations have a very, very powerful meaning or purpose, transformative purpose for being part of it, right? You're doing something important, and that's, you know, key. People will be far more motivated by a big, you know, very motivating purpose than a big paycheck.
I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of, when I bring that up as a sense, and I talk about elite organizations having PTFC, not PTSD. And
right.
PTFC is purpose, trust, focus, and camaraderie. And the purpose piece, when I talk to business leaders about it, they kind of look at me like, and I say, you know, it takes imagination. And this is a real motivator and inspirer, but it takes some imagination and it takes an involvement of your whole organization to get involved with defining that and making it
right.
real and not just a bumper sticker.
No, absolutely. Think about Zappos. I mean, like, how do you, I mean, I'm curious if you know what their, you know, transformative purpose is, but they make shoes, you know what I mean? Or they sell shoes. So what could be massively transformative about that in terms of...
They give a lot of shoes away to people around the world that don't have shoes. They give a key portion of their profits. I think that they say that for every two or three pairs of shoes that are purchased, I haven't looked at this in a while, that they give away a pair of shoes and they send them to places like the Sudan or Eritrea or Zimbabwe
right.
or someplace, and through the nonprofits they give these shoes away, and that's really inspiring to idealistic young people and to idealistic old people like me.
No, I totally agree. That's really cool, and that, I didn't know that, but it makes sense. You know, I'd want to be part of an organization that is, you know, basically upgrading the hygiene and the mobility of the planet than just selling shoes. You know, it's like Google, you know, it's very, very, you know, motivating to organize the world's information into a digital format that's easily searchable than it is to just go work for a firm that sells advertising, you know?
Absolutely. And they do enough stuff. I mean, they are still a business, and they've got to take care of their shareholders and their primary and secondary stakeholders. But they're also doing stuff which is clearly the profitability of is questionable, like digitizing the world's information and and other things that they do, which is just really neat and is bold.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. And that's probably another defining factor right there is boldness, right, of these organizations. Well, you know what? We could go on. And on, and it'd be really fun to do that, but I know you got things to do, and as do I, but really, really appreciate, you know, your coming on today, Bob, and I hope we get to do this in the future, and of course, I stand by to support you any way I can, and I look forward to seeing you when we talk to the Naval Academy alumni group, I think, in April, but before we go, is there anything you'd like to share in terms of how people can stay connected with you? I mean, I know you got a personal blog. You probably should write a book soon, you know what I mean? I'd love to chat with you about that. But how do people stay connected, or if someone wants to follow up with you, is that something you'd be open to?
Sure. The easiest thing, my blog is called Bob's Corner, What's Bob Been Thinking About? And it's kind of all over the map. My next post, which I'll probably post this weekend, will be my review of Lone Survivor. Have you seen it yet?
I saw it a few weeks ago up in L.A.,
I just saw it last weekend, and so I've written a review of it, and I give the movie a B+.
Yeah.
And I say here are the things that I really liked about it, and here are the things that I didn't like about it, and
right.
So I kind of put that down, but they can contact me, and I can put them on distro, so anytime I put a blog, or they can subscribe to it so that they get sent. And it said Bob's Corner, one word, .wordpress.com. Or they can email me at, and if I get a whole lot of them, I may not be able to respond to all of them, but SCHOULTZ at sandiego.edu. And for the work I do, I'm at fifthfactorleadership, one word, .com.
And you have an email form there that, that if they if they forget all that, they can go through your website.
I believe so. Well, I'm not really good at all of this marketing myself stuff. I didn't learn how to market myself in the Navy. I'm still figuring it all out. I do have a website, though. Is that, that's a start, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, that's a great start. It's a great start. Well, anything I can do to help you out, Bob, you know, I'm standing by to support you. And, again, I really appreciate everything you're doing. And I will we'll probably see you soon.
Look forward to it, and good luck. I think I haven't read your whole book, but I've read big pieces of it, and I really like it, and I'm recommending it to a lot of people. My copy I've loaned to a young man who's going through Buds now, but I'm going to go buy him his own copy so I can get mine back.
You swing by HQ, and I'll give you another one, but I'm down to my last two copies myself. We ordered 1,000.
Now, I want to support you. I want to go ahead and buy a copy from the store for real.
I appreciate that. Thank you. All right, Bob. Well, good luck, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Okay, Mark. I enjoyed it. Take care.
All right. Yep. Here, Mark Devine signing out for Unbeatable Mind, and thanks, everyone, for listening. That was fantastic. I'm really excited about that call. So stay in touch and stay focused and train hard. Be safe and have fun. Booyah. Azure.
Well, there you have it. I told you that would be a great conversation with Captain Bob Schultz. So thank you very much, Bob. Look forward to doing that again sometime. All right. Coach Devine out. Train hard. Stay safe. Have fun. Booyah.
Make sure you get home, boys. They got your back. The pride of the fleets, the bright swinging frog.